this is the Loyalty Podcast from New World Loyalty, where we help you make the most of your loyalty strategies by listening to us talk about what we like to talk about most, which is loyalty and loyalty programs. Loyalty programs for CPG, or FMCG products as we like to call them in Europe, have been around for many years, as the Netflix series Pepsi Where's My Jet will testify. But with the rise of direct-to-consumer business models, building direct brand loyalty has become more important than ever. So to help me explore how loyalty can help build these crucial relationships, I'm joined by two guests with a vast experience in this area. So please can I welcome Jason Whiting from LEGO, or very recently from LEGO. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Yeah, nice for you to join us. You're in Vegas today, are you?
I am. Moved here recently.
I hope you've got more sun than we do, that's for sure.
Yeah, 100%.
And Dave Andriadakis from Blue Water TV and previously Kobe Marketing. Hi, Dave.
Hey, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, and you're in Miami, are you?
Close. I'm over in the Tampa area in Florida.
Right. So both a lot sunnier than here. So there we go.
Yeah.
So to get us started tonight, can we each give a brief introduction to yourselves and your experience in this area? So Jason, do you want to start us off on that one?
Sure. I have about 24 years in marketing, but I spent the last 11 years at the LEGO Group, where between 2018 and 2024, I was responsible for overseeing their loyalty program across the global organization, both in our retail channels, plus all the different expansion opportunities we had across the other marketing channels and other retail channels.
Perfect. And as working at LEGO, I imagine it is one of the things I would have loved to have done as a job. So is it as good as I imagine?
Yeah, it's a great company to work for. I recently left the company just about a month ago, but I've been there for, like I said, over 11 years, and I really enjoyed it. It's a really fun company, family owned, and you know, a lot of really, really smart and really fun people in that organization.
Brilliant. And Dave?
Yeah, so I've been in loyalty for over 20 years. I previously was over at Kobe Marketing for about 11 years, where I spent quite a bit of time working in every vertical strategy for our clients. In fact, Jason and I worked on the previous iteration of the VIP program, but also leading innovation for the loyalty capability over at Kobe. Now I've taken on a new challenge, which is direct-to-consumer loyalty. It's like, how do we really grow loyalty in a space that I think is often unattended by brands that are direct to consumer.
And that's exactly what we're talking about here. So just on that, Dave, how have you seen it evolve? What would you say the history of direct to consumer or FMCG loyalty, but basically brands' relationship with customers, how has that evolved over the last sort of 10 years?
Yeah, it's quite a complex relationship. It's largely due to the distribution channels that they have to go through. When you think about where percentages of revenues come from, you've got, you know, distributors out there that are doing some selling on your behalf. You've got a lot of large retailers. You've got resellers that are out there that sometimes take over the brand and do their own thing with it. And of course, you've got your own direct-to-consumer channels. And so it's a balancing act that is often unappreciated by, say, retail or banking or telecom, where they have a direct relationship with the consumer. The biggest change, obviously, was COVID, but I wouldn't say that was the change. It was an accelerant. Brands were already learning how to cooperate with each one of these channels and to, you know, do more in sharing data and marketing strategies. COVID caused a vast acceleration of this because, you know, manufacturers needed to talk to consumers directly because people just couldn't get out of the house and go to the retailers the way that they used to.
Has there also been an element of relaxing from the sellers on their ownership of the customer relationship? Has that also, Jason, has that also been a relaxing position, or is that?
I definitely do not think that happened. And it's one of the challenges that you often see in this space is, especially in franchise models or distributor models, where they've always owned that customer and anything that the brand does feels like it's pulling away. And you also see that just in generally between CPGs and these distributors, when they're going D2C, there's always a challenge there. Often what you'll see is all boats rise because you get more brand affinity. But one of the big challenges between the distributors and the brand are often who owns that customer. And those channels often feel like they're the owners of the customer because they're in the front lines most previously.
So. And how does that pressure manifest itself? Do they raise it at meetings, or do you ignore it, or do you how does that?
No, it's something that comes up into top meetings. It's things within the companies I've worked for, plus people that I work with outside of Lego Group. It always comes to the same point, right? It's top meetings. It's talking about margin. It's talking about customer ownership. It's an ongoing battle. But I think it's really important for the brand to show that loyalty is not necessarily just about the channel. And traditionally, it has been about the retail channel. But when we talk about CPG, it's about loyalty to the brand and how do we keep those customers year on year. And I think that's really what the brands need to really push with those customers.
And did the history that David talked us through there, is that something that resonated with you at Lego? You know, how can you talk us a bit through your journey into this?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I think, yes, it happened with a lot of brands, but it really depends on the organization. When you take something like a Lego or a Nike or an Adidas, where they already had D2C channels before COVID, it was an accelerant, but they were already dealing with this, right? So they were already laying the foundations of this. And this is often what happens in these companies, especially global brands that have either direct consumer channels or they're running through large conglomerates. You often see this. What happened in COVID accelerated it, but it wasn't a new challenge. What it meant was those retailers no longer had customers coming in through their doors. So they were maybe a little bit more open to it. But now that the doors have opened back up, some of those challenges are still there. They didn't go away.
No, I mean, I remember when I was a child having a relationship with Lego, in that, you know, I must have been part of their membership club or something. I've definitely done that before. So it's not new. I guess what you're saying is it's just more automated now.
Yeah. And in a lot of these organizations, what they're trying to do is say, hey, having that brand relationship, that's why people are buying your products, right? So you buy Nike shoes because you like Nike shoes or you're a runner, right? It's not because you're buying them at a particular retailer. And the brands understand that by reinforcing the relationship directly with the consumer actually allows us to push into both those channels, both the direct to consumer plus the partner channels. And we've been building on this for years, right? So you might have started off, for you, you had that relationship with the Lego product as a child. And maybe at that point, we didn't have the D2C business. The D2C business evolved, but now we've seen the importance of that business. And every single manufacturer that's creating a D2C business actually sees that, right? They want that direct relationship with their consumer because they know that they can increase brand affinity. And that's what's really important to the longevity of those brands, as well as the retailers who stock those brands.
And what does the data say? I mean, Dave, I know you're a data call-to guy, because when I've done we've did some research recently for a brand I was working with about omnichannel. And what it found was there was no brand in the UK with over 6-8% where they were buying online, but 95% of customers were then going to store to purchase it. So there must be some evidence, Jason or Dave, that the omnichannel piece supports the in-store sales. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And there's there's some inherent challenges with the model itself, right? So when you're a manufacturer and you're going through each of these different channels, and you want a message to get out, and you want it to be your message, and you want to create that brand affinity, there's 30 other thousand SKUs in the store trying to get that attention for the customer through a retailer. And so ultimately it's going to come down to what they can negotiate. And when it comes down to what they can negotiate, that relationship with the customer is the single greatest point of leverage for the retailer. Now, one thing that did happen during COVID was kind of an awakening. And that is that as brands started to get access to customers, and everybody had to play in the sandbox nicely, manufacturers realized, hey, we're way better at advertising than we are at marketing. And retailers realized the same thing as well. And so the best brands are coming together strategically to try to figure out how to share a little bit of data to try to find ways to cooperatively work with the customer. And Jason, tell me if I'm wrong, did I see in Target a VIP or a loyalty, I think it was a standout for the program in a Target. Was that your doing? Was that something that happened out of your brainchild?
Yeah. So that came out of me and my team. And really it was looking at, like, Target's a great example of a retailer that leans into the brand. So they've done it with Ulta as the other one, right? Where they have the shop in the shop and you can and combine loyalty programs. And you're seeing more and more of this. JD Sports is another one working with Nike. where they're really trying to cross-pollinate the global brand loyalty program with the retail program. The one thing I would say is, I would disagree a little bit, depending on with you, David, when it comes to, you know, some brands that have the D2C channels, they are really good marketers as well. And I would say one of the challenges in that scenario is not how do you let the retailer and share that data, which can be really complex, especially from a global organization.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're starting to share that data, but how does the brand support the retailer's messages in their marketing as well? And that's something I don't think anybody's really nailed right now, because there's so much complexity from a legal standpoint, data sharing standpoint, plus just operational. But I think that's really the future, is really how do we reinforce getting those shoppers into those channels through the overall global message, which is also the message that the customers really respect, right?
Yeah,
they see a Walmart as a place to transact in, but they might see a Nike or a Lego as the brand that they actually have a relationship with. And if we can get them to make that transaction in the Walmart, that's really good for both. But finding that balance is really, really tough.
I agree. I want to tie that into something Ian was asked about earlier, which is the omnichannel aspect of this. I find that just in general, most brands are doing a terrible job at really embracing what a customer would consider omnichannel. Like, many brands are doing email and text, and sometimes the data shows up in the web experience, and we're saying, hey, that's omnichannel. But when you think about, especially generationally, you've got kids under 25 spending almost all of their time online. And it's on YouTube and Pinterest and TikTok and all the social channels they're sharing, and there's TikTok shops that are popping up. Brands are starting to prioritize content that is horizontal or vertical instead of horizontal. And most loyalty programs, whether it's manufacturer or otherwise, are really missing the boat on creating that ecosystem that reflects what consumers are experiencing. Just think about email. It's a junk drawer, right? It's a complete junk drawer. And budgets for email are still significantly higher. Email promotions are significantly higher than they are digital marketing and getting into that social ecosystem. And so I think there's a wave coming as it gets easier and people kind of wake up to this fact that it's just not going to be as effective as it used to be with the traditional channels.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that those retailers really have a good opportunity to amplify this is they get, there's just this massive scale, right? So you're just, so many of your products are going through retailers that have probably teams that are the same size as what you might have in the manufacturer, and you have multiples of those teams, so they can actually focus in those specific channels, which is going to be a challenge for a lot of these big brands, is how do you not just like throw everything out there that's just like whitewashing the wall, right? Like, if you really want to be targeted, you either need really sophisticated systems to do that, or you need the people to actually manage all those different communications channels.
Yeah. So we've talked about, as far as the challenges are concerned, we've talked about pushback from the brands, we've talked about data, we've talked about scale, we've talked about aligning messages, but what about the mechanic, the loyalty mechanic here? So how, because there's many different mechanics that you can use to track transactions. Jace, I guess what you're saying is you would ideally like to integrate with the retailer to get their data to do awards and stuff, or do you do off-pack? How have we seen that working?
Yeah, and I think from that standpoint, it really depends on the brand, right? So if we can do an integration, that's probably the easiest way, right? And make sure that the data is clean and be able to leverage it the best way. That's often going to be a challenge depending on who you are as a brand and who is on the other side as the retailer, and whether they want to play in that space. And it becomes more and more complicated if they want co-ownership of the data that you have, especially when you're talking about multiple retailers, because you end up in a scenario where, you know, one change for one single retailer might have a global impact across all your terms and conditions. The other thing is, go straight to the pack, right? And that is probably your biggest marketing lever as a brand. I mean, if you can promote the Nike Run Club in every single shoe, you're in every single store. But that means you don't necessarily have all the data you could have by having a relationship. So I think it really comes down to what is the brand's relationship with that retailer and how much are you willing to share together. But then you have to offer something up. You have to be bringing something to the table as the brand, because they don't want, you know, this isn't about cannibalization doesn't help anybody, right? So what you want to do is you want to amplify frequency. You want to increase retention of those shoppers. So you need to find a good balance of supporting them, but not pulling those customers away. If you can get an extra sale in your own channel, that's great, but you shouldn't be taking a sale away from your retailer.
Yeah, I want to expand on what Jason's saying. I completely agree with him. Well, there's, like I said earlier, there's limitations. If you're a big box retailer, you've got some brands that are willing to share data and do cool things and all that kind of stuff with you. Every program is different. And because every program is different, the retailer's not going to be able to keep up with the demands of data formatting and sharing and all that kind of stuff, that everybody wants something different. So while there's advances that can be made there, I would do two things. One is, as Jason was saying, go right to the pack because you own that and you can engage the customer there. But two is build your product around an ecosystem that you're enabling, right? You're enabling a lot of really cool things in people's lives, and you get to own that entire space, not just the product that is facilitating that thing. Give them a reason to engage with you outside of the product itself. Bring them back to your website, bring them back to communities, create tribals or tribes and campfires for people to be around and engage that community. And that will build more loyalty that's emotional and lasting than you're ever going to get through, you know, transactional loyalty that you might be able to find a willing partner within a retailer.
Yeah, so it's interesting because you're saying, don't go, because I was thinking if you continue on in that transaction loyalty piece, there's obviously data sharing, which you've mentioned, Jason. There's then on-pack or in-pack ways of tracking that the sales be made. Have anyone been involved in receipt scanning or anything like that, where you can go, we can basically ignore the retailer, scan a receipt and find that? Have you're laughing, Jason. Have you done that?
Yeah. And that was the relationship that we had with Target. Target was definitely was a pilot to see how well the receipt scan function works. And I'll tell you, I've seen it. In my time out in the industry, I've seen it, how many retailers have done this. They've trialed it and they got rid of it. Same thing happened with, you know, Nerf perks and everything else. It's so open to so many challenges, from data like compliance to fraud to ensuring that the data formatting. There's so much that can go wrong with receipt scan.
That's right.
That it needs to just be done. If you're going to go something like that, I think that works for, like, you know, selling cans of soup, right? Like commodity items that doesn't really matter and something really small. But, you know, the industry's been trying to do that for ages and it never works, which is why
we're
looking at more direct relationships and how are we getting that clean data. But David's absolutely right. Like, you have to have a common format, right? It needs to be easy for both sides to integrate. You can't have product teams and engineering teams working for months and months and months trying to figure out a way to move data across the two companies, which is why you also have to simplify. Like, data sharing doesn't work, right? Data co-ownership doesn't work because that adds layers and layers of complexity.
Yeah, I would say, just to add to that, I've watched it go up and down and up in terms of failure, right? So one is early days, receipt scanning technologies were just, you know, the hit rate was terrible. Because there's so many different formats, even within single chains, because they can do different things within different regions within a particular chain, that it was hard to pull that in. Now it got better as AI and machine learning started. You know, we had more optical recognition technology and text reading and mining. It got better. It certainly did. But there's alternatives out there that make it a hard thing to lead with. I want that technology to advance. I know there's some good players out there investing some in that technology. So I don't want to sit here and squash it completely, but it's got some room to grow. One alternative out there, I haven't talked to them in a while, is Acribo. And what they did was they started intercepting the message between the point of sale and the actual printer. And you could intercept that message and then put a ubiquitous or common format, no matter what the point of sale system was. And that got the closest to me to being able to have a national distribution that is receipt-based. But I would still say that was limited to maybe 50% of the customers that you'd be hitting. So try to get them to engage digitally, try to get them to scan something in the pack, try to get them to upload pictures and photos and engage and
I've got some experience of that as well, David. And the issue there is that not everyone takes their receipt these days. And if you don't get the, if it doesn't trigger the receipt, it doesn't. Anyway, I get it, and it's and so who do we think does this well? Or if you created a Frankenstein's monster of things that people do well and created this thing, you know, which examples would you point out? I mean, Jason, you've mentioned Nike a few times. Obviously, you've got the Lego example. I mean, where would you say is really nice best practice?
You know, and I would say probably Nike and Adidas do pretty good jobs, right? Because as David said, they built those communities into their programs to begin with. So they gave people a reason outside of the purchase moment to engage with the brand. And they're pulling people out of those retailers, right? So you will have Nike stores, you will have Adidas stores, but a lot of them will be franchise stores or licensed stores, or they're just in the third party retailers. And they still pull it back. And I think that's really key. Who's doing well? Like, it's really hard, right? Like, I would even say, you know, if you look at Lego, we're on a good path, but like haven't fully integrated it either into those retailers. It's not because this is new, right? It's not because we haven't been talking about this in the industry forever, right? It's just really, really hard. And you really need to find what is that niche thing for your brand that will bring people in, keep them close to your brand, but then how do you push them out there? As manufacturers, everybody's just going to have to keep working on it, invest more time, invest more people, more technology. But what's really challenging is proving the return on that investment. We talk about in the loyalty industry in general, how do you prove the value of retention, right? Because it's not a last click attribution model. When you start moving that into other channels as where that purchase is actually being made, it's even harder to prove the attribution of this. And it often means brands have a really hard time getting the resources they need to really move the needle.
And I suspect that's true. I suspect the return investment's a difficult one to prove in any case, because all of the mechanics we've mentioned, there's a degree of friction. And in any loyalty program, it's always a balance between your most engaged, the people who have the most to gain, or your most loyal customers, and therefore there's very limited opportunity to get a return investment from those customers. But they have the greatest incentive to go through the pain, whereas the customers that are on the edge that you could nudge into greatest behaviors, you want to make it as easy as possible for those customers. And if there is any friction in there, then I think you make it difficult. And so all the things about scanning receipts and all these things, that's why I think, Jason, the closest you can get to proper technical integration, or as you said, Nike and Adidas, who do things where it's a relationship type model rather than a transactional type loyalty program. I think that's probably, does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's where a lot of the focus is, right? So you see like product registration as the trigger, right? Which doesn't just unlock the loyalty benefits, but it unlocks a bunch of different benefits that are integral into the product themselves. Or, you know, like going back to Nike model, right? Like being able to track your shoes, or, you know, additional information about your running that's integral to the product that they're selling, which means you pull into the program, which means that they can reinforce it. And I think that's what the brands really have to be focusing on going forward.
I'm nodding and smirking because like if you had asked me who's doing it the best, I would come up with the same answers. I would put Nike at the top, having been on campus and watched what they do and what they have in store. They're going to continue to be the best for a long time at doing this. I think Lego does a fantastic job. Companies like Harley Davidson have really built some great things around the experience. But there's an unfairness in saying these are companies that do this well. It's like saying to a brand, hey, simply go and get a top 5 global following and everything else is easy that, right? And so when the brand equity is there and you're capitalizing on that brand equity, fantastic. And I'm glad that those brands are doing that. It's hard to give that advice to an up and coming brand to say, do what they did. So I look at brands like a little lesser known, but very impactful in their categories is a brand called Blackstone. And Blackstone does the flat top griddles. I don't know if you've seen these where it's an outdoor griddle. They just dominated the outdoor grilling market. They surpassed Charbroil as the number one outdoor appliance that people are buying. And they did it by creating a tribal following. They did it by getting out there and saying, hey, you like getting outdoors, you like grilling, you like expanding the same thing that you've been doing as a kid with your dad, expand it into something else and open up the opportunities. And And Green Egg did this as well. Like Green Egg was a fantastic version of this as well. The other two examples I have, one's probably not gonna be that popular, but Bombas socks is a good one, right? Where they got out there and said, hey, there's something unique about our socks, money back guarantee. And they took a category by storm, and that's cool. But the unpopular one right now is Temu. I think Temu is doing an amazing job, and they're doing it through a form of loyalty, which is almost like multi-level marketing, where they're saying, hey, get your friends to sign up. We'll give you these codes. You can earn some money against some products. And so their biggest ambassadors are, you know, kids ages 16 to 22 years old. They're out there trying to get products for college and things like that. And you saw their big splash in the Super Bowl. So they're really hitting hard on there's a group of people that we can activate to build our brand. And so there's alternative models to the traditional point system and working through.
And of course, the model that Rick Ferguson talks about all the time is Taylor Swift as well. You know, she does all of this naturally, right? And whether it's a deliberate strategy or not, who knows? But she does all of the relationship type stuff really well. So just to draw to close tonight, if you're going to give advice to a brand manager, what would your three pieces of advice be if you're thinking about going into loyalty or building a direct to consumer type loyalty proposition? Jason, do you want to kick us off on that one?
Yeah. So I would say the first one, and it's the one I give every time I have one of these conversations, but really be true to who you are as a brand. Like you said, there's so many different types of loyalty programs and mechanics out there. That what are the ones that really resonate with your brand and really align with it? If you're a transactional brand, yeah, lean into transaction. If you're a community brand, lean into community. So I think if you're just looking at your program, whether you have one today or you're starting one, really first start off with what are the really brand values? What are the brand truths that you have out there, and build your program around that? And the second one is, you know, especially if you're in the CPG realm, you don't know where you're going to go. So don't build yourself into a box. And this is what this whole conversation is about, right? Is either retailers have built something that's very retailer agnostic, or CPGs have built something that's very brand agnostic. And you know it's going to have to cross these channels. COVID, as David said, accelerated this. We don't know what the future holds, so make sure you have it fairly open. And then really, what is the foundation that you're going to use to prove the effectiveness of this? Are you going to use something like an engagement score? Are you going to do return on investment? Are you going to do, you know, lifetime value? But get those metrics out there at the beginning. Get your leadership aligned with it, that these are, you know, these are the leading indicators of how we're doing, and these are the results that we expect to achieve from this, and make sure they're really, really measurable. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck in a point later on where you either got something that doesn't align with your brand, you can't expand it, or you're going to be in a place where nobody believes in it. And that is not a place you want to be in the loyalty industry.
No, I think that's for CPG as anything else. And Dave, what about yours?
Yeah, and it's a treat to be able to give advice specifically for direct-to-consumer brands, because it's quite different than what I might say to a retailer or a bank or along those lines. Number one is you do not need to reinvent the wheel if you're not doing this already. If you're new to this, find a working model and build upon that than trying to be the best. It's a much shorter distance to good than it is to perfect. And so you're going to be building new muscles as an organization in order to pull this off. So get to good and stay there for a minute before you try to overextend. And when you do that, my second piece of advice is look at your customers in a distribution of frequency, in a distribution of spend, in a distribution of how engaged they are with the brand. You'll find that you'll design a much different program than when you're thinking about your best customers. Your best customers are only 5 to 8% of all of your customers. And the bottom third of all of your customers make up about 30% of your revenue. So you've got to pay attention to every version of interaction. And the last thing I would say, and this is kind of a new concept for everybody in the loyalty space, and that is that acquisition, engagement, and retention budgets are not separate things. These are all decisions that brands have to make in terms of where to place the best spend to return dollars back to the shareholders, but also to build a brand over time. And most often I see acquisition is left completely separate from sometimes engagement and loyalty are together, but since loyalty often has a hard time with attribution, it's looked at as a cost. Stop it. Try to figure out a way to look at all three of those in terms of customer lifetime value and get the right types of customers during your acquisition strategies upfront, you'll see that it starts to pay off quicker to help feed the beast to grow the loyalty program, engagement, get better partners in, and so on and so forth. So look at those budgets together, bring the departments together to make it happen.
So on that very sound advice, just leaves it to me to say thank you to our guest tonight. So please can I say thank you to Jason Whiting.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you to Dave Andriadakis.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. And if you like this podcast, please like, share, or comment on LinkedIn using the hashtag TheLoyaltyPodcast. And we'll look forward to your company again soon. Thanks then, and goodbye.